and thank you and shy and bashful and meaning not to impose. Caleb Folliwell. Regina, what a class act she is. So sweet. She was in the locker room at all times. It was just all boys mooning each other. Ryan Gentles. It wasn't like she was some bird and we were like, wow, look at the rare talent on tour with us. Please come right in. Drink our beer. Hang out with us, please. You know, it was equal.
Regina Spektor. I became a cousin. The Kings of Leon were a family, and the Strokes were a family, and I got to be the cousin.
Ben Blackwell. It was a fucking awesome bill, if you think about it. Regina Spektor, Kings of Leon, and Strokes. Julian was still reckless Julian then, climbing ladders on the side of the stage, jumping into the crowd. Albert Hammond Jr. I remember lots of cocaine, lots of late nights. So debaucherous. Regina, Caleb, Julian, and me. We just never slept. Everyone wanted to keep up with us, because you just want to keep on hanging out longer. Nathan Folliwell. Let's just say, that was when we first got introduced to the big bad world of things that will make you able to party until 5 a.m. every single night. Albert Hammond Jr. I was doing a lot of cocaine. And what was funny was when Caleb and I would do some, he'd be like, don't tell Jared about it. And I'd do some with Jared, and he would be like, don't tell Caleb. I'd go back and forth. In the meantime, I was doing double duty over here. I won't tell anyone anything. Nathan Folliwell. Julian left the bus at one point and stayed with Jared in his room for like 5 days straight. The crew would all be anxiously waiting like, okay, shit, where is Julian? And then he would just get off our bus like, hey guys. We had a pretty vicious basketball rivalry between the Kings and the Strokes, so that was a lot of fun. They were all tall, and there are five of them, so that is a slight advantage. But they were playing in high-heel boots or something. So at the end of the day, it was evened out. Albert Hammond Jr. Everything was becoming a little more comfortable. You'd go into your hotel room and think, wow, we're staying here? Julian and I were still rooming together. Back then, our roommate situation was me and Julian, Fab and Nick, and Nikolai and whoever. Poor Nikolai. Nathan Folliwell. That whole tour was just an after-party. Albert Hammond Jr. One night, we were staying at the Mandarin Oriental in Miami, and at 8 o'clock in the morning, Julian threw my phone from the hotel into the water. Caleb Folliwell. We've done lots of crazy shit together, thrown tables off of buildings and stuff. If they didn't tell you about that, I won't. I'll just say that all I did was aid. I didn't want someone to go off the building, so I just helped. It was not a one-man job, but it was one man trying to do it, and I was like, fuck, this guy is going to die. I'm going to help him. Albert Hammond Jr. Ask Caleb about midget porn. Caleb Folliwell. How much time do you have? Nathan Folliwell. We had a nice little competition going of who could shock the others the most with their taste in all things sexual. I'm not sure who won. I think a couple people dry heaved, but I don't think anyone actually puked. But to me, a dry heave is a win, isn't it? Like, if you get to the point where you might lose your lunch, especially with worldly guys like us and the Strokes, it takes a lot. I want to say it was our contribution that won. We were a little more adventurous, because we were pent-up Christian boys just looking for a sweet release. So I'm going to say it was us that introduced them to the midget porn. What I know for sure is, it was there, it was watched, and it was enjoyed by most. Nick Valenci. They were very young. Jared, the bass player, was 14. Literally, I'm not even exaggerating. He should have been in 9th grade, and he was on tour with us. It was really not an appropriate environment for a 14-year-old. It wasn't really appropriate for anyone. Steve Trachtenbreit. My favorite Jared quote was from NME, or Q. He said, I'm only 16, and I've already had crabs 3 times. I was like, good for you, man.
Jenny Eliscu. I mean, those guys were kids. They were all really young, and they were kids from small-town USA. Every year they have this family reunion where they like to joke about the high percentage of people there who don't wear shoes. I mean, what's more innocent than being barefoot? The Strokes were gritty New York schoolboys, whereas I couldn't have imagined the Kings of Leon getting on the subway by themselves, you know?
Nathan Folliwell. They were young, too. Had Jared not been 9 years old, they would have been considered a young band as well. But with the Strokes, it was kind of like, it's your freshman year at high school and your brother is a senior. Takes you through the ropes, tells you what girls to stay away from, which teachers are assholes.
Jenny Eliscu. I remember I reviewed a show they played at Irving Plaza for NME and wrote some line about how by the end of it there wasn't a pair of dry pants in the house. And then the next time I saw them, Jared, who was like 16 at the time, was like, that thing you wrote about the girls with their pants, did you mean, like, girls, you know? And I'm like, yes, what else would that mean? Just delightfully sweet, down-to-earth, and unsophisticated.
Harmar Superstar. Me and Kings of Leon went to Sadie Frost's house in London with Kate Moss one night and played guitar in her treehouse for like 9 hours. Anthony Rossomando. Her kids' playhouse. I first met Kate Moss up at Sadie's. There was like a kiddie slide, and in the morning, we'd be all high on MDMA, in a little kiddie house playing guitars. I was involved with some very weird things at her place, like a threesome on the top floor with her friend, and I look up, and there's pictures of Jude Law and her and the kids on the wall. And I'm like, what am I doing? She was so up for it. Those Londoners are up for it. But Kate? I cheated on my girlfriend with Kate. I fucked up in the biggest way possible. So why did I do it? Because Brendan Benson and Jack White grabbed me at the bar at the Dorchester and said, you're the one. Do it for the USA. Matt Romano. I've heard these Kate Moss stories where I've been like, are you telling me that if I was two doors down at 4 a.m. last night, I could have fucked Kate Moss? Harmar Superstar. The Kings of Leon were still really innocent, like little kids. That night, before we went to Sadie's, we were all at a weird bar dancing, and I was dancing with Kate. I'd just met her a week before or something, and they said, how did you do that? How do you just dance with her? And I was like, just go up and dance with her. It's easy, she's super nice. And I remember the dudes being like, okay, and trying to dance with her. 3 hours later, we're all in a treehouse playing guitars together, making out. I was like, see? Their confidence level skyrocketed. It's fun to watch that kind of confidence develop, and you're like, dude, take what you want. It's right there.
Regina Spektor. The energy was really big with the Kings of Leon and the Strokes.
Steve Trachtenbroit. I saw people dressing up as the Strokes for Halloween. Grown-ups.
Regina Spektor. There were a lot of people around that wanted stuff from them, wanted to be around them. Kind of a groupie vibe all the time. And so there was a feeling of, let's band together and protect ourselves. There was a lot of stuff that I didn't get that was draining or difficult. I didn't understand that kind of pressure. I just saw the fun stuff, like when we got to L.A. and they were on the cover of Rolling Stone, and it was amazing to watch them squeal like little kids.
Ryan Gentles. Yeah, we got the cover on the second album. Caleb Folliwell. It was a nutty tour, but we learned a lot. We grew a lot, and our music changed on that tour. And from then on, all of us were trying to outdo each other. When the Strokes would make an album, we were the first ones to hear it. And when we would make an album, they were the first ones to hear it. We'd all sit there nervously watching their reaction, and they'd do the same. We would always be like, we're going to be better than that record. And it'd be like, all right, motherfucker, we're going to be better than that record. Austin Skaggs. Oh, the Kings are competitive to the point of I'm going to be skinnier than you. Even that kind of shit. My jeans are going to be skinnier than your fucking jeans. My mom is going to sew me the skinniest jeans. I'm sure the first night the Kings met the Strokes, they were awestruck. I mean, they were their heroes, you know, their blueprint. But the second night, they wanted to tear their heads off. They were as friendly as you can be when you want to tear someone's head off and shit down their skull. Nick Valenci. Now the Kings of Leon and Regina Spektor are much bigger stars than we are. They certainly both have a lot more mass pop appeal than the Strokes do. And I feel great about that. I feel incredibly surprised. Chapter 61. The James Murphy Show. Andy Greenwald. When I left high school, I cared about two things. I cared about indie rock, guided by voices, and I cared about Biggie. I was really into hip-hop. Then I went to college, and in college you make friends based on what band posters people have on their wall, or what CDs they have. On the first day of school, I found these friends, who I'm still friends with, who had a Guided by Voices box set. It was like, that's it, we're friends. But I remember playing them a Nas album, and they looked at me like I was defiling a child. They couldn't understand why I would listen to this if I liked something so demonstrably good. It all felt very balkanized. And what was thrilling about James Murphy and the music DFA was doing, and the beginning of Napster culture, was suddenly it felt freeing. You could jump from one genre to the other. You could publicly say you liked one thing and another thing, you know? James articulated that in a way that was incredible, because he had spent all of those years with bands like Six Finger Satellite and stupid indie rock bands that he had worked with. He had the cred, but he was also, I like to do a lot of blow and dance all night. Luke Jenner. Have you read Retromania? Simon Reynolds talks about LCD and our generation of bands as basically the first true collage artists. Daniel Kessler. LCD was unique. They came from a different place. It wasn't so black and white. They were many different things at once. A live band, a dance band. Alex Kapranos. When you heard LCD Sound System, it was like, oh, right. So they're doing it over there as well. Before, you'd have the punk rock kids, the indie kids, and then you had the clubbing kids. Those groups didn't really socialize that much. And then suddenly, everyone came together. Juan McClain. It went from being a group of people who were entirely living in the moment, doing things basically for fun, to a few of us experiencing pretty quick and immediate success. Phil Mossman. Pat and James had been flirting around with LCD for years. It was kind of a joke thing. Then James did those songs, and suddenly he had this band, LCD Sound System. He named the band after his sound system. Then, suddenly he was like, I want to do some shows. Pat's going to play drums. I want you on guitar. This girl Nancy is on keys. And he kind of headhunted Tyler from Chick 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 and poached him. And that was it. Juan McClain. Losing My Edge made it so James could launch LCD Sound System as a band. Phil Mossman. Our first show was in London. Marcus Lamkin. Losing My Edge blew up, and suddenly it was come to London and play this song live. And he's like, I don't have a band. And he gets Nancy and Pat, you know, all of his friends together. All of these people have careers now. My whole career is entirely indebted to him. Juan McClain. It just opened up all the doors for us. I signed a publishing deal that gave me enough money that I could quit my job teaching and just focus on music. I mean, it was for an absurd amount of money. Phil Mossman. But it wasn't like a communal thing. I would have loved to have been more of a part of the writing process, but that just wasn't up for discussion. James locked everyone out. Jonathan Galkin. James is a singer-songwriter. A lot of that first record is James playing everything. That's like some print shit. This is what you do. Play this bass line and play it like a monkey. Got it? No, don't do that. Play with your thumb. Just your thumb. Literally. Phil Mossman. He became very opposite of Dave Holmes in a way. Whereas Holmes was like, I need you to do this, I need you to do that. James was like, I understand what you're doing, but I can actually do it myself. I don't need to hire people. That was him beating Holmes. You can't even fucking play anything. You can't engineer. I'm a great engineer. I'm a great drummer. I'm a great guitarist. I can program synths. You can't fucking do anything other than play records. And I've learned how to do that now as well. He did it all himself. Jonathan Galkin. Look, James Murphy is the James Murphy Show. And you have to, if you're going to be in the room. You just have to know what you're in the room with. Phil Mossman. He didn't appreciate producers that came up as DJs. He didn't buy it. He wasn't fucking buying it. Whereas we were all sold on it because that's how records were being made in England. LCD was a big fuck you. It was like, fuck you, Dave Holmes. Look what I can do. I remember there was a poll of coolest people of 2001, and James was like number 8, and Holmes was number 9. James was like, yeah! He was really fucking excited that he was one above Holmes on the cool list. He's very competitive. Jonathan Galkin. It's why he hates producing other bands. Competitiveness. I can do it better. Why are you doing it like that? Not that he's always right. Andy Greenwald. I did this story on them. I went over to the DFA office and interviewed James and the other guy, Tim. It was in the West Village, like on 8th Avenue. I sat with Tim and James, and I remember Tim didn't talk very much, and James talked a lot. He was a star. Juan McLean. The problem was that Tim got left behind because he was the one that didn't have his own thing. He had DFA Productions, which was entirely dependent on working with James. So James goes off on tour with his new band, and Tim is stuck back home with literally nothing to do. Tim Goldsworthy. I enjoyed making music more than anything else. So when LCD started, I was fine. I have absolutely no interest in being a frontline artist myself. Jonathan Galkin. Even when James left, like when Losing My Edge took off, he put the band together and kind of self-funded for them to get to England. Tim, his instinct was like, it's shit, mate, and he'd just go upstairs. If I was Tim, I would think, well, I'd like to be a part of that. Tim could have jumped on that train if he wanted to. Also, in EMI's original deal with LCD, Tim, as James's partner, got a deal too. A record deal, which triggered hundreds of thousands of dollars for Tim. Tim Goldsworthy. When we signed the EMI deal for all that money, there was an open deal for me at exactly the same level as LCD. But the idea of that is just horrific to me. I like being me, and I can't do the thing of creating another character. Artists are a special type of person, and I don't want to become that special kind of person. Jonathan Galkin. It was a 6-figure advance. EMI said, you want half? Okay. Can we hear what you're working on? The same way we heard Losing My Edge and wrote a check? He said, no. So they were like, okay. Then no. Tim Goldsworthy. James and I both set out to create DFA to change our lives for the better. I was living in New York. I'd managed to get rid of my old life. I was making fun music with my friends. I was with the woman that I loved, and also getting respect from people who I cared about. It was a win-win situation. And James was finally in a band, his band, which he wanted, and he was being James. Jonathan Galkin. But still, we supported Tim. Tyler Brody. We bought him a lot of gear to record an album that he never recorded. Tim Goldsworthy. I did make an album. We had a bit of a budget from DFA Records, and they paid for my friend Darren to come over from the UK for a couple weeks. We bought some equipment and made an LP, but the plan was that James was going to come back and help me with it and finish it off, as I had helped him with LCD. And that didn't happen. Phil Mossman. James was going through this reinvention of himself where nothing is impossible. Honestly, he's like a manic explosion of uber-creativity. He became a kind of Superman, and Tim's English, very reserved. Surely he could have made his own record, but I don't think he had that kind of mania. Jonathan Galkin. We never heard a note. No music ever came of this, and no money was ever gotten from EMI. Tim Goldsworthy. When I kind of played it to people, I didn't play it to them, I just snuck it in. And the usual reaction was like, whoa, what is this weird 70s prog jazz stuff? It's very Stevie Wonder with a bit of British prog in there. It sounds horrendous, that description, but yeah. So nobody was that keen on it, to be honest. And, you know, Jen and I had just had our first child, so the idea of going on tour... And also, I had already started falling out of love with DFA, so the idea of tying myself more into DFA without the support, I didn't really feel supported. It was very, oh God, Tim's doing his weird stuff again. Tyler Brody. Maybe he was just like me, scared to release his own stuff. I don't know. It's weird. Tim Goldsworthy. I'm not sure how much DFA were aware of how far it had gone along, but the LP is there at DFA. I never picked up the hard drives. It's just at the studio. There's about 11 tracks. The songs were all called Love, and they were just numbered, like Love 4 or Love 7. James Murphy. When two dogs meet and they smell each other, one dog is bigger. Tim was above me. I wouldn't have deigned to tell Tim what to do. I would never have tried to get something from him or given him school assignments. I wouldn't have dared. There's nothing weird about panicking to make your own record and mix it. I think he should have made the record, and I would have loved to have helped him, but he didn't want anything to do with that. He would have had to ask me. I make records with people where I basically make the record. I have no problem with that. I'll write the song. But to try to do that with Tim would be psychological insanity. Jonathan Galkin. Originally, there was also a plan where Tim would help James make his first record, produced by the DFA. James went to that residential farm in Massachusetts, a studio farm. They had nice gear. It is very residential and chill out there. James went for like 3 weeks. Tim, in great Tim fashion, protested this LCD project and said, I'm not going to the farm, and I don't want to help you. Go do it yourself. Tim Goldsworthy. Johnny clicks. That's what he does, just clicking away at the internet. I honestly think you could buy an iPhone app to do what John does. Jonathan Galkin. I didn't say this to him, but I was thinking, what are you doing? You're blowing it, dude. That's another train that's leaving. You should be part of that, even if you're just in the room. What are you going to fucking do here for 6 weeks? Go sit on a farm. Go twiddle knobs up in Massachusetts. He didn't want to do it. Didn't want to give James the satisfaction of like, okay, this one is for you. It was very selfish. Tim Goldsworthy. LCD wasn't a problem for me, especially at the start, because we did co-write. James Murphy. Tim was not involved in making the first LCD record. Well, Tim was involved in Yeah, and a little bit in Beat Connection. But it doesn't matter, because to me he was so critical to those songs. Tim liking the drum sounds in Beat Connection was such a big deal to me. Phil Mossman. James and Tim were working together in the early part of it. But very quickly I think James thought, I can do this programming. Actually, it doesn't look that difficult. I can figure that out. He figured it out, and then pretty much shut the door on everyone. Jonathan Galkin. Honestly, Tim really shit on a lot of stuff that James was doing, like turned up his nose. He was snobby. So he was like, it's a bit shit, mate. It's a lot of that. It's a bit shit. Juan McLean. Tim's role was the guy with his arms folded in the back of the room. Even physically in the studio, that was his stance. He was that guy. Tim Goldsworthy. As soon as the prospect of big money came in, James put up the barriers. I'm going to write this all myself. I don't need your help. This is my thing. I'm just like, okay, dude, whatever. That's fine. Chapter 62. Room on Fire. Andy Greenwald. One thing about the 2000s is that everything happened too fast. The time that passed between Nirvana and Candlebox probably was 2 or 3 years. The time between The Strokes and Long Wave was like 18 months. And there were diminishing returns. The Strokes weren't really that big. Everyone needed them to be that big and desperately wanted them to be big. But they kind of weren't. Brian Long. Bands like The Strokes, they sucked on the proverbial major label tit, drank the last gulp of milk that was there. They were the handoff from one era to another era. They prospered financially from that 90s alternative rock era, but they are paying for it. I remember when their second record came out. We really liked them and were championing them. But we were all wondering if they could develop in a way that would make an interesting career. The analogy we used to make was, will they end up making a London Calling? Could they be that? Are they that creative and that musical? Or is it going to be just cutting different colors from the same swath of fabric? And that's kind of what happened. J.P. Bowersock. The backlash against The Strokes' second record was strong, which is so funny because it was as good as or better than the first. Steve Ralbovsky. I stand by Room on Fire. It's a great record. Jesse Malin. It's actually even better than their first record. Jim Merlis. Julian doesn't want to be produced. And my frustration with that second record is if it was mixed a little differently, it would be a classic. Dave Gottlieb. Room on Fire is as good as Is This It. The problem was the band did not sell it. You'd ask, what's your vision? What are your goals? What do you want to do here? They didn't really have an answer. They'd say, well, we want to do a video where we're all Simpsons characters. And they wouldn't be joking. Their big marketing idea was, we want to get a riverboat on the Mississippi and have contest winners come and go up and down on the riverboat, and we'll play. My thing was, don't put people on a boat. And anyway, it was going to cost $750,000. Mark Spitz. I'd first heard that album at this restaurant that used to be under the old WizKid offices on 10th Street. Donal, it was called. Julian played me Under Control and Whatever Happened, and one more song. I think it was the single. Dave Gottlieb. 1251 was the first single because Clive Davis wanted it, because the promotion department wanted it. But it was the wrong choice. Mark Spitz. Julian was very nervous. He was very apprehensive about that record. He really, really wanted it to be successful. I felt like he was under a lot of pressure. I felt like he wasn't 100% happy with it. I felt like maybe he wanted it to sound differently. Maybe more of a step forward. Maybe not a Gordon Raphael record. I invited him to the book release party for my novel, and we wound up at the library afterward. And after that, we ended up with these two girls back at my apartment doing coke all night. I can't remember their faces or their names. They were hipster girls. I don't know whose coke it was. It wasn't mine. But Julian, he kept playing the album on my little red boombox. And he kept going, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. And I was like, it sounds really great, man. It's gonna be great. Because I thought it was a great record. And he kept going, I don't know. I had a copy of the first Talking Heads record, and he played that song Don't Worry About the Government over and over again. And he was saying, oh well, I wish it sounded like this. I wish it sounded like this. And I was like, it does sound like this. It was good New York new wave music with melody and good lyrics and personality. And he just wasn't hearing what he heard in his head on that particular record on that particular night. And I don't think he was making the music that he wanted to make, as beautiful as some of those songs are. And I don't know if he felt like The Strokes were holding him back, or a circumstance was holding him back, or the drugs and the booze were starting to hold him back and he was getting a little sick of them, or the lifestyle, or the city. But that's what it seemed like. Dave Gottlieb. Then they made the Tron video, which was something else that I was vehemently opposed to. Roman Coppola made great videos for them. His creative influence was there on Last Night, and it was there on Hard to Explain. I was like, why do you guys want to make a video that looks like Tron? Well, we love that movie. I'm like, listen, I was the demo when that movie came out, and it sucked. It's not a cultural touchstone. This isn't going to resonate with the people who are your audience. It's not. It's not going to make sense. I told Rabowski, the video is not good enough. He goes, because the band didn't want this song and you see it on the screen. And he was right. You watch that video and they are bored. The point is, no one liked the second record because the band didn't position it. They waited to do press until it was too late. They went with the wrong single because of Clive. I think Rabowski's version was they put it on the label to make that call on the first single, and now they have something to be pissed off at the label about if they fail. But that's kind of the wrong attitude to have at that point, because the most important thing is what you do first on your second record. Jim Merlis. Anyway, when the reviews started coming in, they all said that it sounds exactly like the first record. Carl Swanson. The Strokes came up just as the crisis of the music industry was starting to really happen. Dave Gottlieb. If the Strokes had happened 5 years earlier, they would have sold 2 or 3 million records, not 1 million records, because of the internet. J.P. Bowersock. During the making of the Strokes' second record, the head of RCA got replaced by a bean counter. Dave Gottlieb. The label was going through a lot of executive changes at the top, and by this point you knew that there were people finding Strokes music through other means. Rastambot Mangalish. I read about the Strokes in Rolling Stone, about how they'd only released 3 songs and they were selling out shows in New York. This was back in 1999 or maybe 2000, so of course I went on Napster and I downloaded their 3 songs. John Heilman. The moment when it first became clear that the combination of digitization, which had been affecting the music industry for a while in the form of compact discs, and then networking were going to pose the same kind of fundamental existential challenge, that moment is a moment of terror and exhilaration. These were the first set of bands that were bewildered by, but also exhilarated by, and thrilled by the opportunities that come with that kind of breakdown and shattering of the old traditional structures. Dave Gottlieb. You have to sit there and go, okay, this is going to happen faster than it did with grunge because of the internet. It's going to happen faster. So how do you prepare the record company to succeed with it? And how do you prepare the band to succeed with it? J.P. Bowersock. CD sales were about to dive because of digital files. The industry put nothing in place with how to make money in a digital world, and clung to the old model because it was so profitable. But the old model was dead. Suddenly a rock band, even a great rock band like the Strokes, meant nothing, because a pop band was going to have 10, 20 times the sales. So that's where you put your money. That meant the label didn't get behind them, to a degree. Steve Rabowski. Look, phenomena by their nature don't repeat. The Strokes were clearly a phenomenon, and just by its nature, there couldn't be another phenomenon. Anything that followed, whether it was as good or not, it was never going to achieve the same accolades. Mark Ronson. Okay, yes. Being first out of the gate makes you a target. But when you are the first to plant your flag in the sand in the way D'Angelo was for modern soul music, people will always care because you helped them discover something. You have to be better than everyone else as well, not just because you're first. You also have to be great. Moby. The Strokes were the first band of that era that actually went beyond just being PR darlings, and suddenly people were buying the records. It's also interesting in their case, because they never sold that many records, but they made really good records. The reach, the awareness of them was so much greater than the record sales. Dean Wareham. It's hard to make something perfect. They made a perfect record, and that's hard to do again. But I don't feel for them, because I'm sure they're doing fine. Maybe not in their heads, but in their bank accounts. I feel bad for people who are broke. But I can see why it's hard for them. Because as big as they are, they still didn't get Kings of Leon huge.
Jenny Eliscu. It's important to zoom out and look at what happens when a genuinely so fucking good it's insane band happens. It's always disappointing on the commercial scale. The Stooges were never a commercial success. I think it's more about the DNA of the underground. The best things from the underground, the most worthy of a huge audience, are also built to fail. And yeah, the internet culture of today accelerates the pace at which you're looking for the next example of the thing, and we get bored with the thing because everyone knew about it so quickly and disseminated it so quickly. Hipsters get over shit so quickly. And our era is the rise of the hipster as a genuine commercial force. But it's really important to state that there's a difference between the underground and hipsters. The underground is real and permanent. I'm a member of it. And we reject the mainstream, and always will. And so even the best things that deserve to be as big as the Beatles, like the Strokes, it's just like they can't resist sabotaging themselves somehow. It's just part of them, you know? Because they're part of the underground. They have an underground sensibility. It's more art than it is commerce. And that's what makes music great. And that's what makes some of the best music sometimes unlistenable to almost everyone. The Killers were never part of the underground, and the Kings of Leon were never part of the underground. Fuck no.
Chapter 63. There's definitely some bad feelings there. Phil Mossman. They began it all together, and then not. And knowing those two, there was probably never a discussion about it. It was probably just like Tim wouldn't show up one day, so James got fed up with him not turning up. So he just did it himself, and then probably just stopped inviting Tim down to the studio. James Murphy. One day he said to me, "I'm just going to pop out for a minute." And he never came back. I called him and I said, "Where are you?" "I'm at home." "But you said you were going to pop out for a minute." "Yes, but I didn't say I was going to come back." Phil Mossman. Oh yes, if Tim's got some kind of bee in his bonnet, then yeah, he's likely to not show up for something. He'll just go out for milk and not come back. Marcus Lamkin. Let's just say everyone has their own story. Toward the end, there was a lot of Tim not being around and coming in and doing stuff. But James is very much of a get-stuff-done sort of guy. He's not going to wait around for some English dude taking his sweet-ass time drinking cups of tea. Let's just put it that way. Jonathan Galkin. I tried to navigate and negotiate all of this stuff, but they did not want to hear it from me, neither of them. Fuck no. When they were around each other in the office, there would be this heightened surreal politeness. And then as soon as James would leave, Tim would be like, "That fucking cunt. Have you heard Losing My Edge? What the fuck is that shit, mate?" Or then Tim leaving and James being like, "Dude, he's driving me crazy. You know that remix that's due? He still hasn't done the drum programming. He was down there for 12 hours yesterday. He told me he was going out to dinner, and then he never came back. And when I asked him why, he said, 'Well, I didn't say I was coming back. I just said I was going out to dinner.' I'm not joking." Tim Goldsworthy. Dance music has a beautiful history of strong, powerful lyrics. To change that to Daft Punk is playing at my house, it was just, "Fuck off, you're ruining it." I couldn't support him. Marcus Lamkin. James was blowing up and becoming Mr. Famous. He was now the name that everyone associated with DFA. James Murphy. He probably said that I said that my time was more valuable. He spent much more time. He spent so much time. and what he did was beautiful at times. Marcus Lamkin. The injustices Tim felt were magnified by the fact that James was not there. They were still working on stuff as a production duo, but James was on the road a lot with LCD. So he'd roll in, have only one day, and he'd come into the studio, boom, 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 it's done and out. Phil Mossman. James is very well-rounded with his capabilities. If you put him in a studio on his own, there's nothing he can't do. He's a fantastic engineer, and he's wide but shallow on every instrument he knows. He's not an expert on anything, but he can knock a good tune out on any instrument you care to put in front of him. He's self-sufficient. Marcus Lamkin. Tim had all the opportunities that James had. He just decided to not take them. I'm sorry, but I don't want to hear your little sob story. Jonathan Galkin. I have never heard a piece of Tim Goldsworthy solo music in my entire life. I'm not sitting on 7 tracks he turned in. I don't have the unreleased Tim Goldsworthy record. I don't have a single song. Not a single song. Tim Goldsworthy. The LP in parts is all at the studio. Though I'm not sure they know that, to be honest. Send me a copy if you find it. Marcus Lamkin. Anything that he's ever played me is amazing, but his standards for everything are just ridiculous. Juan McLean. When they eventually left, Tim and his wife Jen, they left almost literally in the middle of the night. Tyler Brody. Really, it was so weird. Tim came over and asked, "Can I meet with you?" I'm like, "Okay." He said, "Yeah, you know how things are going downstairs?" And I was like, "Yeah, it's going really good." Because I wasn't paying attention at all. Tim was like, "Wait, what?" Juan McLean. I didn't know they were leaving. We have friends that didn't know they were leaving. It was definitely not the case that they were being banished or anything like that. I think things had become so difficult between James and Tim just felt like it was the only thing to do. Marcus Lamkin. James got super famous, and clearly when every magazine and everyone in the world is saying you're the greatest thing since sliced bread, he might have got a little big-headed at times. There's definitely some bad feelings there, and maybe things weren't that awesome, but we all make choices in our lives, and I don't see how anybody was ostracized. Tyler Brody. We did not kick him out. He left us. He told me that he didn't want his child to grow up with an American accent, so he was moving to England. Jonathan Galkin. I was here the night he left. I was working late. He hadn't been here. I swear we had changed the locks, and he had to buzz to get in. He was coming from his going-away party at Milk and Honey. That was James and Tim's spot. Tyler Brody. He came over to my house and asked to buy a certain piece of gear. And I said, "Let's talk about this in the morning with everyone, all the partners." Then that piece of gear was missing the next day, and Tim was gone. We've never seen him since. Tim Goldsworthy. Tyler is just a crazy stoned multimillionaire. James is a sociopath. James Murphy. Americans are much more prissy and prudish and jealous about shit. Britain has a long history of whining and saying it's not fair. Watch America's Next Top Model and watch the British Next Top Model. What do American girls say? "I'm not here to make friends, I'm here to win." What do the British girls say? "It's just not fair, it's ridiculous, it's not fair." They're both awful. Self-deluded, no self-analysis, but one of them is like, "Fuck you." They burn bridges and start swinging. And the other one's like, "It's not fair." Jonathan Galkin. One thing you have to keep in mind is that Tim and James have very different pasts. James had a decade of failed indie bands, failed in quotes. Tim had a decade of being part of something that was wildly successful. Another moving train that he said fuck you to another James, James Lavelle. So there were parallel universes of the 90s for each of them. James's indie bands sounded like other indie bands that didn't do as well as those other indie bands. He was always second fiddle, the perpetual opening act kind of thing. And Tim was Tim, the Mo Wax star. Warren Fisher. I was sad that Tim left, and I don't know what happened. Never really got to the bottom of that. But he was the one, in my mind, who brought the European perspective on electronic music to New York. And then James was like, yeah, but I just want to dance. Somehow, those two in a room created that sound. And from that, they were able to mount a revolution. Chapter 64. The Wrestler.
Christian Joy. Karen was just such a maniac in the beginning. There was nothing like it. I mean, rolling all over the place, amazing star power. She's really shy, and I think it was pretty cathartic for her to have this really intense release. Karen O. With the 9/11 thing, it was the first time that the States had been penetrated in a really profound way, which burst the bubble, right? And when you're living a 15-minute walk from where it happened, you feel that in a much more apparent way. It just feels so much scarier. The security blanket was just completely torn off. Like, if they could achieve that, then what next? We were living with that danger. People needed release. There was this urgency all of a sudden for release. I was all about urgency, which is why we called that first record Fever to Tell. You never knew how long anything was going to last. Every moment was ephemeral.
Harmar Superstar. Karen is more go hide under a couch for 2 days and come back with an album. She can be really chill or she can be really intense. There was definite inner turmoil, not even between the band members, I think just with herself. She had weird freakouts. Asif Ahmed. Karen had a meltdown. I think it was Birmingham, England. She kicked in a tour poster that the promoter had framed. And then she threw this massive tantrum and then doused me with iced tea. I chased her down the hall and doused her with a gallon of milk. Harmar Superstar. She can be shy, but with Karen, if it's 5 people in her house, then all bets are off.
Karen O. We were riding that wave of that New York revival, but it seemed like a really small scene that we came out of. Even though there was the internet on the horizon, and there was this new promised land of being able to reach and be heard by a worldwide audience all of a sudden, with much less effort, it was still just on the horizon. Then all of a sudden the world starts taking you seriously as a band, everything is changing, the hype machine is moving, and you are just surviving. We toured for 3 years behind that same record. We'd written it in 2000, and we were still touring it in 2004. We had to survive that insanely precarious razor's edge that you walk on as a band that's hyped so young, trying not to get fucking sliced down the middle. Christian Joy. After she fell off the stage in Australia, she started to slow it down. Karen O. I'm half Polish, and when we finally got to Poland in 2006, we got this amazing host who took us around, telling us all about all the culture. And I'm pretty detached from my roots because my dad had a single mom. He was fully Polish, but he just didn't fully connect, so it was all news to me, basically. But I remember our host saying, here in Poland, the way we like to live is, who knows if there's going to be a tomorrow, so let's take on the night like it's our last, every fucking night. I was like, no wonder, duh. That, coupled with the melodrama, is me in a nutshell with music. I related to that so much. That's how we felt around that time. Who knows what tomorrow could be, so let's make it count tonight. That idea was such a huge inspiration and motivator, which unfortunately ended up with me falling off the stage. And then I knew I needed to shift gears.
Harmar Superstar. It was a festival, Livid Festival, in Sydney. I was there for that. She fell off the monitor.
Karen O. During the song Rich, I was on the edge of the stage, sort of draped over the monitor with my legs in the air, and I was really drunk. I flipped off head first, hit the guardrail, and landed on my back. Then the monitor fell on my head.
Harmar Superstar. She was leaning over the monitor. It was pretty terrifying. She was just getting into the show. She was kind of in a weird mood already before she went on stage. And then she was just going for it and doing more of a dangerous show.
Karen O. I was kind of lost in that thing of being a spectacular performer that people like to see self-destruct on stage. And that was the way I could blow off steam, because there was just an enormous amount of angst I felt at the time and at that age. The amount I was injuring myself was just escalating, escalating, escalating. When I saw that film, The Wrestler, it was basically, that's me. I totally related to that because the more Mickey Rourke hurt himself, the more ravenous his audience was. And in response to that, the more the expectation he felt to provide that for them. And that's kind of where I was.
Harmar Superstar. All of a sudden she was on the monitor, and it just tipped and she was gone. The monitor fell on her head. That's how I remember it. It was a 5 or 6 foot drop. She landed right on her head. She didn't get up. We were all silent.
Karen O. Security pulled me back up. I was limp, but still singing the fucking song. After I finished, I asked our tour manager to feel a bump on my head that was rapidly becoming another head. Someone brought over a big bag of ice and a red cloth. I was wearing a red ensemble, so people in the audience thought it was all an act. I sang Maps and then said, I'm sorry that we have to end the show early. I'm going to the emergency room.
Harmar Superstar. I helped Dave Burton get her in the ambulance.
Karen O. The next day I looked like I had elephantitis. I couldn't walk without pain. But I was a serious trooper, dude. I played a show 2 days later and my boyfriend at the time, Angus, pushed me out in a fucking wheelchair.
Harmar Superstar. She was kind of a zombie for days after that. That scared her.
Karen O. It could have been nasty. I mean, the only thing that saved me from breaking my neck and my spine was the fact that I was so wasted that I was limber. I fell off like a wet noodle. But then again, I probably wouldn't have fallen off if I wasn't that drunk, so.
Harmar Superstar. You don't want to go back on stage after you fall off onto your head. Getting on stage almost killed you.
Karen O. I kind of learned the hard way what I could do and what I can't do and what I was capable of. That really informed and set the course for me.
Harmar Superstar. She just didn't want to be there as much as she thought she did.
Christian Joy. I mean, how long can you keep up with that?
Asif Ahmed. They started getting the nickname the No-No-Nos in the business. They would turn down a lot of stuff, like SNL. They would turn down magazine covers. There was the Vanity Fair issue, the music issue 2004. Wherever Liz Phair is in that lineup, it's supposed to be fucking Karen O. In Karen's defense, she was very noble. They agreed never to do covers without all three of them. Everyone just wanted to talk to Karen because she was this captivating girl. I remember getting a wonderful call from Jimmy Iovine where he told me to go fuck myself because of Vanity Fair. I was in London with the band and their families and my phone rings. Everyone saw my face just kind of dropping because the caller ID says 310-865 and the 1000. That's the Interscope main line. I knew that it was Jimmy Iovine calling because we said no to the Vanity Fair thing.
Karen O. I'm like Year of the Horse, and you know what they say about horses. You can lead a horse to the water, but you can't make them drink. The creative projects and how I took things in and how I learned, I always had to do it my way in the end, you know? I would drink up what looked tasty, but I could never be forced.
Chapter 65. So people in their 40s in Boston are listening to Interpol.
Sarah Lewitton. Interpol was my new Radiohead. Antics was the album I couldn't hold my breath for any longer.
Sam Fogarino. I remember being well prepared to make that record. Daniel Kessler. We were very focused, which made it feasible for us to do bright lights and antics very close together. Sam Fogarino, after all that touring, we just got so much better. That's what a band's supposed to do. You're supposed to play music. And we did a lot of it. So we were able to go in and just nail it. Peter Kadis, with the kind of success that those guys had, the pressure is there. It took forever. We just couldn't get it done. We went past our deadline, and in the end, the label was like, if you don't have it done on this day, the record won't come out this year. It will get bumped to next year. I remember we were mastering on a Friday night, just finishing, and I'm heading to the door. Paul's like, I'm used to this, but you're not. Are you ready for this? You're not going to like this. I'm like, what? And he opens the door, and the sun is coming up. Sam Fogarino. When we finished mixing the record, Matador got us a limousine to take us from Bridgeport back to the city. The time was so tight that we were doing the sequencing in the limo. The next day, we were going right into a rehearsal studio to go tour with The Cure on the Curiosa Festival. No breather for anybody. Daniel Kessler. That tour was really fun.
Jenny Penny. That was when Carlos was wearing the holster all the time. I loved the holster. It was hot. Sarah Lewitton. Carlos looked like Hitler Youth, which, being a little Orthodox Jew from Jersey, was my, like, jungle fever.
Sam Fogarino. It was this full-blown touring festival. Robert Smith curated the whole thing. And there we were opening, playing right before The Cure. It was insane. We'd arrived at another level. Paul Banks. Robert is a total dude. You see the photos and you think that guy might know how to write poetry. But in reality, you hang out with him and you think, I bet he's really good at soccer. Sam Fogarino. Robert would hop on our bus and play cards. He was a card shark, man. He was really good.
Jenny Penny. Karen won money from Robert. Karen Rutner. We were playing in the back of the bus, and I think it was something like a $20 ante. Robert asked me if I wanted to be dealt in, but I told him I didn't have the money, so he put in $20 for me, and I won. He kept trying to convince Carlos to play too, but Carlos insisted that he didn't gamble. Robert then told Carlos that walking down the street every day was a gamble.
Paul Banks. Another time, a very late-night hotel room situation with Robert and the management. I remember him saying that they never did festivals unless they were headlining. And I remember kind of feeling the implication there. Like, here I am, not headlining your festival. But I didn't get a sense that it was intended to put me in my place. It was just, we were talking late in the night. And what he said happened to really resonate with me. In the same way that I've always loved that Vincent Gallo will only be in the magazine if he's on the cover. That's a sign of greatness. People that will go to those lengths. But I felt at the time, I don't live in a world where we can fucking do that. I'm going to take what I can get. Sam Fogarino. I remember it was my birthday on that tour, and I was DJing this big old after party. I couldn't believe that I was standing there with Robert Smith on my birthday and DJing. At that point, I was like, how could it get much better than this? This is insane. I think that was in Toronto, Canada. I remember him leaning over and saying, are you having fun, Sam? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, because you look so serious. And I was like, yeah, that's me having fun. That's what it looks like.
Sarah Lewitton. According to my blog, it was Tuesday, October 21st, 2003, when I first heard the new songs. I wrote, speaking of Interpol, I saw them last night in concert, and their new songs made my heart beat in my pants. Kim Taylor Bennett. It's such a sexy album, and bold. It was a tweak and innovation enough away from Turn on the Bright Lights to not be considered derivative, but the DNA of those songs was still familiar enough that from the first listen you just fell in love. It helps that Slow Hands was such a huge hit, their biggest. As a galvanizing party anthem of the era, it was right up there with the Strokes' Last Night and the Killer Somebody Told Me. Sarah Lewitton. I remember riding my bike around Soho while listening to it and singing along at the highest volume possible while dodging